This is Audible.
Hello, I'm Robert Fulghum, reading to you for Random House Audio from the 15th anniversary edition of All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten, a book I have reconsidered, revised, and expanded with 25 new essays. The original edition of this book began with words important enough to repeat again. If I could give you this book in person, I would ask you to keep these things in mind. First, what you are about to hear was written over many years, a little bit at a time, and often reconsidered and revised. During that time, I lived in many places, had many jobs, and traveled widely. The essays and stories were initially addressed to friends, family, a religious community, my students, and myself, with no thought of publication in book form. I think of it as my stuff, an account of what goes on in my mind and life. A part of this, what I learned in kindergarten, was passed around until it took on a life of its own and began to appear on refrigerators and bulletin boards. One day, the essay was sent home from school in the knapsack of a child whose mother was a literary agent. The mother wrote to me, "Had I written anything else? Well, yes." And one thing led to another in a wonderland sort of way. As a kind of truth and packaging statement, I tell you here and now that I have changed some names and some facts to protect those who are either innocent or crabby or both. I am not an investigative journalist. Furthermore, I have an official storyteller's license. A friend made it up and taped it to the wall over my desk. The license gives me permission to use my imagination in rearranging my experience to improve a story, so long as it serves the standard of truth in the best sense. The truth of poetry and parable do not compete with the truth of science or the courtroom. I trust you to know the difference. Finally, I will not make the usual reservation that the opinions expressed within are entirely my own. No, the older I get, the more I realize how much I think is a composite of the goods selected from the supermarket shelves of the world of thought. What is mine is an attitude about what passes through my mind. To expound on that theme, I begin this 15th anniversary edition with a profound admonition found on a bumper sticker. Don't believe everything you think. Words on the back bumper of an old blue Ford pickup truck. I was alone in my car in Santa Fe, New Mexico, January, snowstorm at nightfall. For several blocks, all I can clearly see in front of me is this message on the truck's bumper, made urgent by flashing red brake lights. Creep a block, stop, flash. Read. Creep another block, stop, flash, reread. Don't believe everything you think. Those words left a permanent afterimage in my mind. They provoke me to recall the dumb or useless or naive ideas I've held in a lifetime. Ideas I once thought were indelibly tattooed on my brain cells. Ideas I have since discarded when new evidence and further experience forced me to change my mind. Often when reading through old journals, I have thought to myself, I really cannot believe I ever thought that. But I did, and I would have fiercely defended what I thought in the open court of public opinion. On the other hand, there are things that I think, that I do believe, and these convictions remain steadfast, holding tough and true through all the weather of experience. Some ideas last. They do. The question, of course, is which ones? Well, that's a field-testing issue, isn't it? All I Really Need to Know I Learned in Kindergarten has been in print more than 15 years now. In light of my Santa Fe bumper sticker experience, I wondered how the ideas in kindergarten would bear up under critical scrutiny. Do I still respect the convictions woven into the stories in that book, or have I changed my mind? And if I have changed my mind, what to do? Revising and reissuing a book published 15 years ago is not commonly done, but why? If the book can be improved and expanded, then it might continue to be useful and meaningful. The kindergarten book represents an attitude, a way of looking at things, so why not look again? So I looked. Once I set to work, I did more than expected. I removed several stories entirely because they are dated, or because I have truly changed my mind, or else because I have a new story that better speaks the truth I want to express. 25 new essays have been added. Most of the old material has been edited or tidied up for the sake of clarity. The order has been changed for the sake of continuity. As it now stands, the book seems like a final form. And yet, I wonder, how will I feel about this writing 15 years from now, if indeed I'm around to feel it all? If life goes well, I will probably reconsider and revise the book again. I hope so. And the reason will remain the same. I will have changed my mind, recognizing that I no longer believe everything I once thought. Or else I will also find then what I have found now, that many of my convictions have not altered and bear repeating. My storyteller's creed is an example. I believe that imagination is stronger than knowledge, that myth is more potent than history, that dreams are more powerful than facts, that hope always triumphs over experience, and that laughter is the only cure for grief. And I believe that love is stronger than death. To begin with, did I really learn everything I need to know in kindergarten? Do I still believe that? Here is the original essay, followed by my editorial reaction. Each spring, for many years, I have set myself the task of writing a personal statement of belief, a credo. When I was younger, the statement ran for many pages, trying to cover every base with no loose ends. It sounded like a Supreme Court brief, as if words could resolve all conflicts about the meaning of existence. The credo has grown shorter in recent years, sometimes cynical, sometimes comical, and sometimes bland, but I keep working at it. Recently, I set out to get the statement of personal belief down to one page in simple terms, fully understanding the naive idealism that implied. The inspiration for brevity came to me at a gasoline station. I managed to fill my old car's tank with super deluxe high-octane go juice. My old hoopy couldn't handle it and got the willies, kept sputtering out at intersections and belching, going downhill. I understood my mind and my spirit get like that from time to time, too much high-content information, and I get the existential willies. I keep sputtering out at intersections where life choices must be made, and I either know too much or not enough. The examined life is no picnic. I realized then that I already know most of what's necessary to live a meaningful life, that it isn't all that complicated. I know it, and have known it for a long, long time. Living it, well, that's another matter, yes. Here's my credo. All I really need to know about how to live and what to do and how to be, I learned in kindergarten. Wisdom was not at the top of the graduate school mountain, but there in the sandpile at Sunday school. These are the things I learned. Share everything. Play fair. Don't hit people. Put things back where you found them. Clean up your own mess. Don't take things that aren't yours. Say you're sorry when you hurt somebody. Wash your hands before you eat. Flush. Warm cookies and cold milk are good for you. Live a balanced life. Learn some and think some and draw and paint and sing and dance and play and work every day some. Take a nap every afternoon. And when you go out into the world, watch out for traffic, hold hands, stick together. Wonder. Remember the little seed in the styrofoam cup? The roots go down, the plant goes up, and nobody really knows how or why, but we are all like that. Goldfish and hamsters and white mice and even the little seed in the styrofoam cup, they all die. So do we. And then remember the Dick and Jane books and the first word you learn, the biggest word of all. Look. Everything you need to know is in there somewhere. The golden rule and love and basic sanitation, ecology, politics, equality, and sane living. Take any one of those items and extrapolate it into sophisticated adult terms and apply it to your family life or your work or your government or your world, and it holds true and clear and firm. Think what a better world it would be if we all, the whole world, had cookies and milk about 3 o'clock every afternoon and then lay down with our blankies for a nap. Or if all governments had, as a basic policy, to always put things back where they found them and to clean up their own mess. And finally, it is still true, no matter how old you are, when you go out into the world, it is best to hold hands and stick together. My editorial response to that essay, 15 years later, I call Deep Kindergarten. As I read this now, I am 66 years old. Not so old, really, but I've been around a while. Kindergarten is a long way back there. What do I know now? The kindergarten credo is not kid stuff. It is not simple. It is elemental. The essay answers the questions asked sooner or later by every one of us who once stared out a classroom window wondering, why am I here? Why do I have to go to school? Well, we are sent to school to be civilized, to be introduced to the essential machinery of human society. Early on in our lives, we are sent out of the home into the world, to school. We have no choice in this. Society judges it so important that we be educated that we must go. It is the law. And when we get to school, we are taught the fundamentals on which civilization rests. These are first explained in language a small child understands. For example, it would do no good to tell a 6-year-old that studies have shown that human society cannot function without an equitable distribution of the resources of the earth. While this statement is profoundly and painfully true, a child cannot comprehend this vocabulary. So a child is told simply that there are 20 children and 5 balls to play with. Likewise, 4 easels, 3 sets of blocks, 2 guinea pigs, and 1 bathroom. To be fair, we must share. Likewise, a 6-year-old will not understand that, by and large, it has been demonstrated that violence is counterproductive to the constructive interaction of persons and societies. True, but a child can better understand that the rule out in the world and in the school is the same. Don't hit people. Bad things happen. The child must understand this rule is connected to the first rule. People won't share or play fair if you hit them. It's hard to explain the cost and consequences of environmental pollution and destruction to a 6-year-old, but we are paying a desperate price even now because adults did not heed the instructions of kindergarten. Clean up your own mess. Put things back where you found them. Don't take what's not yours. What's not to understand about that? Take this sentence. The history of society is more defined by its understanding of disease than its formulations of philosophy and political theory. That's true. basic sanitation. Keeping excrement off our hands as well as out of our minds is important, but it's enough to teach a child to use the toilet, flush, and wash his hands regularly. And so on. From the first day, we are told in words we can handle what has come to be prized as the foundation of community and culture. Though the teacher may call these first lessons simple rules, they are, in fact, the distillation of all the hard-won, field-tested, working standards of the human experience. Once we are told these things, we soon discover we are taking a lab course. We are going to be asked to try and practice these precepts every day. That's because we know that knowledge is meaningful only if it is reflected in action. The human race has found out the hard way that we are what we do, not just what we think. And this is true for kids and adults, for schoolrooms and nations. You know, I'm sometimes amazed at what we did not fully grasp in kindergarten. For example, in the years I was a parish minister, I was always taken aback when someone came to me and said, "I've just come from the doctor, and he told me I have only a limited time to live." And I was tempted to shout, "What? You didn't know? You had to pay a doctor to tell you at your age? Where were you the week in kindergarten when you got the little cup with the cotton and the water and the seed? Life happened, remember? A plant grew up and the roots grew down. A miracle. And then, a few days later, the plant was dead. Dead. Life is short. Were you asleep that week, or home, sick, or what?" I never said all that, but I thought it, and it's true. The idea in kindergarten was for us to have the whole picture right from the beginning. Life and death, life-death, one event, one short event. Don't forget. There's another thing that not everyone figures out right away. It's almost impossible to go through life alone. We all need to find our support group, family, friends, companions, therapy gatherings, teams, church, whatever. The kindergarten admonition applies as long as we live. When you go out into the world, hold hands and stick together. It's dangerous out there. Lonely, too. Everyone needs someone. Some assembly is always required. What we learn in kindergarten comes up again and again in our lives as long as we live, in far more complex polysyllabic forms, to be sure, in lectures, encyclopedias, Bibles, company rules, courts of law, sermons, and handbooks. Life will examine us continually to see if we have understood and have practiced what we were taught that first year in school. Across the entire course of our lives, we will wrestle with the questions of right and wrong, good and bad, truth and lies. And again and again and yet again, we will come around to that place where we came in, to that room where the elemental notions about humanity were handed to us with great care when we were very young. Of course, it wasn't literally all you really needed to know. Of course not. Certainly not. But if you didn't get this basic stuff to begin with, you and society will pay a heavy price for your failure. And if you did learn it and do practice it, then all the rest of what you needed to know has a lasting foundation. There now, the kindergarten credo, amplified, reconsidered, but basically unchanged. That's what I believe and know and trust at age 66. Continuing this theme of ongoing life, here is an essay called "The Rest of the Story." And so then, what happened? An urgent question out of the bedroom darkness, asked by my children when they and I were young. Just when I thought I had slam-dunked a story ending, just when I was certain the children were safely in the arms of the Sandman, a small, sleepy voice would plead, "And so then what happened?" And no matter what I replied, the plea went on, "Please, Daddy, tell the rest of the story." In cranky desperation, I would resort to apocalypse. Suddenly, a comet hit the earth and blew everything to pieces. Silence. So, what happened to the pieces? It doesn't matter. Everybody died a horrible death, especially all the little children who were not asleep. I also tried. The father sold all the children who would not go to sleep to a passing gypsy who ground them into sausage meat. The first children to be ground up were those who would not stop asking questions. Now, go ahead. Shame me. But it worked. Well, most of the time. On reflection, I suspect such gory endings were what they really liked most. Perhaps it was a scheme to see just how far I would go, to see how crazed their father really was. Now I am dealing with grandchildren who have the same restless minds, but I am wilier now than I used to be. To the inevitable quest for more, I reply, "Only your father knows the rest of the story. Ask him to finish it when you get home." But you know, the children are right to ask. As long as life goes on, something always happens next. There are always consequences, always sequels. Anticipating future bedtime insistence, I've been reviewing my repertoire of stories. And I must say I wonder myself, what did happen next? For example, after the la-di-da with Little Red Riding Hood, did the word get passed around among wolves to stay away from smarty-pants little girls who are magnets for trouble? And how come Red's bedridden grandma was living way off in the woods alone instead of in a retirement community or a nursing home? I mean, what's the rest of that story? Or how about Alice? Could she find her way back into Wonderland in middle age when she really could have used a little excitement in her life? Of course not. Whenever she approached a looking-glass, she touched up her makeup. After the blind men examined the elephant and came back to the king with their paradoxical impressions, did they pool their contradictions and re-examine the elephant? Don't bet on it. They'd rather have their heads cut off than give up their prejudices. The blind wise man who grabbed the tail insisted, "An elephant is like a rope. Everybody else is wrong." The blind wise man in the middle declared, "No, an elephant is like four tree trunks. Everybody else is wrong." And the blind wise man who encountered the trunk insisted the elephant was a hose, period. Or take the story of Snow White. Could Snow White really live happily ever after when the prince knew she had been living with seven little men for some time? No way. He'd always bring it up when they had a family fight. What did you really do with all those little men? And Cinderella couldn't have lived happily too long with a prince who couldn't recognize her unless she was wearing the right slippers. And remember the story of the emperor's new clothes. The emperor had been duped by a tailor into believing that the clothes he made were so magnificent that only the pure of heart could wear them. When the emperor strutted his stuff in non-existent clothes, the kid said what everybody could plainly see, "The emperor is stark naked." What happened to that kid? He was hauled off home and sent to bed without his supper for being a big mouth and making trouble for his family. The kid had always been told, "Be truthful, speak your mind, be true to yourself, and have the courage of your convictions." But the kid found out the hard way what the real rules were. Don't make waves, keep your mouth shut, cover your butt, don't be a hero, and mind your own business. Whistleblowers, like girls who marry a prince, do not live happily ever after. And the kid wrestled with this reality as long as he lived. Okay, call me old, call me cynical. Treat me like the parents treated the kid who called the emperor naked. Tell me I should be like the blind men and not rearrange my stories in the face of further information. Maybe I know too much and have lived too long. Better I leave truth out of bedtime stories or pass the buck to their parents. It's too soon to tell them the world is not always nice or fair. Children will find out the rest of the story on their own. Soon enough, when they are older, there will be sleepless nights when what will happen next will not be a plot inquiry, but the entreaty of prayer. Here's a story about spiders, pretty much unchanged from the original. This is my neighbor, nice lady, coming out her front door on the way to work and in her looking good mood. She's locking the door now and picking up her daily luggage, purse, lunch bag, gym bag for aerobics, and the garbage bucket to take out. She turns, sees me, gives me the big, smiling hello, takes 3 steps across her front porch and goes, "Wah!" That's a direct quote, at about the level of a fire engine at full cry. Spiderweb. She has walked full force into a spiderweb, and the pressing question, of course, is just where is the spider now? She flings her baggage in all direction, at the same time does a high-kick, jitterbug sort of dance like a mating stork in crazed heat, clutches at her face and hair and goes, "Aah!" again, at a new level of intensity, tries opening the front door without unlocking it, tries again, breaks the key in the lock, runs around the house, headed for the back door, Doppler effect of, "Aah!" Now, a different view of this scene. Here is the spider. Rather ordinary, medium gray, middle-aged lady spider. She's been up since before dawn, working on her web, and all is well. Nice day, no wind, dew point just right to keep things sticky. She's out checking the moorings and thinking about the little gnats she'd like to have for breakfast, feeling good, ready for action. All of a sudden, all hell breaks loose. Earthquake, tornado, volcano, the web is torn loose and is wrapped around a frenzied moving haystack, and a huge piece of raw but painted meat is making a sound the spider has never heard. Rah! It's too big to wrap up and eat later, and it's moving too much to hold down. Jump for it, hang on and hope, dig in, what? Human being. The spider has caught a human being. And the pressing question is, of course, where is it going? And what will it do when it gets there? The neighbor lady thinks the spider's about the size of a lobster and has big rubber lips and poisonous fangs. The neighbor lady will probably strip to the skin, take a full shower and shampoo just to make sure it's gone, and then put on a whole new outfit to make certain she is not inhabited. And the spider? Well, if she survives all this, she will really have something to talk about. The one that got away was this big, and you should have seen the jaws on the thing. Spiders. Amazing creatures. They've been around maybe 350 million years, so they can cope with about anything. Lots of them, too. Get this, 60 or 70,000 per suburban acre. Yes. It's the web thing that I envy. Imagine what it would be like if people were equipped like spiders. If we had this little six-nozzled aperture right at the base of our spine, and we could make yards of something like glass fiber with it. Wrapping packages would be a cinch, and mountain climbing would never be the same. Think of the Olympic events, and mating and child-rearing would take on new dimensions, and, well, you take it from there. It boggles the mind. On the other hand, cleaning up human-sized webs could be a mess. Well, all of this reminds me of a song I know. And you know, too. And your parents know. And your children, they know. About the eensy-weensy spider. Went up the water spout. Down came the rain and washed the spider out. Out came the sun and dried up all the rain. And the eensy-weensy spider went up the spout again. You probably know all the motions, too. In fact, it's hard to sing it without the motions. So, what's the deal here? Why do we all know that song? Why do we keep passing it on to our kids, especially when it puts spiders in such a favorable light? Nobody goes, "Wah!" when they hear it sung, or when they sing it. Maybe because it puts the life adventure in such clear and simple terms. Small creature is alive, looks for adventure. Like us. Here's the drainpipe, a long tunnel going up towards some light. Spider doesn't even think about it, just goes. Disaster befalls it, rain, flood, powerful forces, and the spider is knocked down and out beyond where it started. Does the spider say, "To hell with that"? No. Sun comes out, clears things up, dries off the spider, and the small creature goes over to the drainpipe, looks up, thinks it really wants to know what's up there. It's a little wiser now, checks the sky first, looks for better toe holes, says a spider prayer and heads up through mystery toward the light and wherever. You know, living things have been doing just that for a long, long time, through every kind of disaster and setback and catastrophe. We are survivors, and we teach our kids about that, and maybe the spiders tell their kids about it, too, in their spider way. So the neighbor lady will survive and be a little wiser coming out the door on her way to work, and the spider, if it lives, will do likewise. And if not, well, there are lots of spiders, and the word gets around, especially when the word is, ah! Now, parenthesis at the end of this old story, some new thoughts. Often, when speaking in public, I begin by saying, I will sing silently. As a clue to what's going on in my mind, I explain I will make some motions with my hands. I ask the audience to help me out by doing the same thing when they understand what's going on. When you get it, get in it. It's the spider song, of course. And I have great memories of huge rooms full of people silently singing the Incy-Tincy Spider, or the Itsy-Bitsy Spider, depending on your view of that, while doing the motions and grinning. They always grin, and they always applaud themselves at the end. Did you know that you can sing the words to the Itsy-Bitsy Spider to the tune of the Ode to Joy portion of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony? With some minor adjustments, it works. Listen. Eensy, teensy, weensy spider, it went up the water spout. Then the rain it came, and then the rain it washed the spider out. Then the sun came out, and then the sun it dried up all the rain. Then the eensy, teensy spider, it went up the spout again, da-da-da-da. Got it? You might call this combination of the spider song and Beethoven's Ninth the fight song of the human race. I once got 1,000 people to do it, motions at all, and we grinned and laughed and applauded ourselves at the end. Both pieces of music are about the same thing, the capacity of life to triumph over adversity, about perseverance and adventure for spiders and for people. Here's a new story about puddles. It's May in Central Park in New York City. An afternoon shower followed by seductive spring sunshine lures busy people off sidewalks and onto park benches. At 80th Street and 5th Avenue, there's a path into the park on which the rain has left an obstacle course of puddles. A small child, kitted out in full rain gear, runs splashing through a puddle. Yeah! His mother, likewise rain-proofed, runs after him, shouting, No, no, no. Catching his hand, she pulls him back into dry land and barks sternly, No puddles, Jacob, I told you, no puddles. The child strains outward and away from her like a guy wire from a tent in a windstorm. He whines. The mother pulls him farther away down the path. The child upshifts into a wail. The mother tries to pick him up. The child goes limp and screams. It's a standoff, one of those child-in-the-checkout-line-at-the-supermarket deals. And this kid is a black belt screamer. The mother is so embarrassed. People are staring. What did she do to him? A well-dressed, middle-aged man observes from a nearby bench. He's wearing polished black leather wing-tipped shoes. Between him and the mother and the child who high is a large puddle. The man in the wingtip shoes stands, walks deliberately into the puddle, wingtips and all, grins, shouts, Hey, hey, hey! Mother and child look up. The kid goes silent, stands still. Well, this scene is too good to be true. How can I stay out of this? I get up off my bench and walk into the puddle to stand beside the grinning man. I'm wearing serious leather sandals and socks. Feet are soaked, but I grin at the man and the mom and the kid. A fashionably dressed young woman takes off her shoes and joins us, as does her dog. The kid laughs, lets go of his mom's hand, and marches into the puddle. All eyes are on the mom. Now at center stage, the mom wears an expression of pained pleasure. She's caught again in a parenthood paradox. On the one hand, the child must learn to mind, but then what harm can a puddle do if the kid is wearing rain boots? She doesn't want him to get sick, but of course everybody knows you catch colds from germs on other people's hands, not from puddles. It's so hard to back down when you said no. But it's not wrong to change your mind. She doesn't want her child to follow the example of strangers, but all these three people have done is to stand in a puddle and grin at her. How can so much be at stake over such a small event? What's a good mother to do? Being a parent always involves such hypocrisy. If she were a kid, she'd be in the puddle now. She walked in puddles when she was a child and came to no harm, and her mom probably shouted, "No puddles," at her, too. Does parenthood always mean being driven by the autopilot of the past? All of this races through the mom's mind in nanoseconds. The waiters and the watchers are waiting. She can't stand there forever. The mom smiles, laughs, walks into the puddle. Her audience applauds. The waiters shake her hand, shake each other's hands, and go their ways, wet feet and all. The child has a pleased but stupefied look on his face. Adults are so weird. He will not understand how weird until he is one. So, you may ask, did this really happen? Well, yes and no. The day and the park and the puddle were real. The small cast assembled in this little arena was there. And the inclinations we all had were right and true. But, in fact, the mother pulled the kid off down the path, still barking "No puddles" at him, and leaving the rest of us grumpily minding our own business. Still, it might have happened. It should have happened. Puddles are there as a test about staying young as long as you can, and all the adults there that day failed the test. How I hated walking away thinking, as I have too many times in my life, that next time, or when I have time, or when circumstances are just right, I will do what my heart says do. Sometimes acting foolish and being wise are the same. Later that afternoon, I went back to do what I knew I should have done. Too late, of course. Too late. Mother and child and nice people and puddle and opportunity had gone. Now a story in two parts, one old and unchanged, and a new part that changes everything. Elias Schwartz repairs shoes. He is short and round and bald and middle-aged and Jewish. An old-fashioned cobbler, says he, nothing more, nothing less. I happen to be convinced that he is really the 145th reincarnation of the Hi-Ho Lama. See, the Hi-Ho Lama died in 1937, and the monks of the Saskia Monastery in Tibet have been searching for 40 years for his reincarnation without success. The New York Times carried the story last summer. The article noted that the Lama would be recognized by the fact that he went around saying and doing wise things in small, mysterious ways, and that he would be doing the will of God without understanding why. Well, a guy like that would be worth looking for, all right. And I found him. Through some unimaginable error in the cosmic switching yards, the Hi-Ho Lama has been reincarnated as Elias Schwartz. I have no doubt about it. My first clue came when I took my old loafers in for total renewal. The works. Elias Schwartz examined them with intense care, and with regret in his voice, he pronounced them not worthy of repair. He wouldn't do it. Well, I accepted the unwelcome judgment, and then he took my shoes, disappeared into the back of the shop, and I waited and wondered, and then he returned with my shoes in a staple brown bag for carrying, I thought. When I opened the bag at home that evening, I found two gifts and a note. In each shoe, a chocolate chip cookie wrapped in wax paper. and these words in the note. Anything not worth doing is worth not doing well. Think about it. Elias Schwartz, the Hi-Ho Lama, strikes again, and the monks will have to go on looking, because I'll never tell. We need all the lamas here we can get. Now for the sequel. People often ask me, are your stories true? Are the people real? The simple answer is yes. The more complicated answer is that I am a storyteller, not, as I have said, an investigative journalist, and a good story can be improved by adding necessary facts, a little spice to the stew. Or a dash of hyperbole may be used to encourage laughter, and sometimes I combine two very similar good stories into one better story, sacrificing what is literally true for the sake of truth. Often, it's necessary to change names and certain identifying details to protect the privacy of the individuals about whom I write. Not everybody wants to be well known. And a case in point is the Hi-Ho Lama. The story is absolutely true. But from the beginning, the shoemaker was adamant about not being identified. He felt it was not right to get credit for simply doing what everybody ought to do in the first place. Please don't use my name or tell people where my shop is, he asked. So I made up a name, Elias Schwartz. And it was just as well. The shoemaker's real name was too improbable to be credible. His real name was Eli Angel, the shoemaker. Eli Angel. Mr. Angel is dead now, and I feel free to correct the facts and tell you the rest of the story. Eli Angel was an Orthodox Sephardic Jew born on the island of Rhodes, and though his formal education was limited, those who knew him considered him a very learned man. He could hold his own in Greek, Spanish, French, Hebrew, and, of course, English. He knew history and philosophy and theology. And a generous man, he was active in helping other immigrants settle into their adopted country. In his neighborhood in Seattle, he was revered for his many small acts of perceptive kindness, for believing that whatever good a man does comes back to him. When he died, the synagogue was filled to overflowing. They called him a tzaddik, a righteous man, worthy of respect. Now, by amazing coincidence, my wife, a family doctor, knew Eli's wife. My wife, the epitome of a medical discretion, had never told me that she was Mrs. Angel's physician. After Eli's death, Mrs. Angel was feeling pretty bad and came to see my wife. She missed her beloved husband. She wished more people had known him. So my wife told her the story of the Hi-Ho Lama from the kindergarten book and explained that millions of people knew about her husband. They just didn't know his real name. His acts of kindness had come back to comfort his wife. Doing good things without expectation of reward was Eli Angel's specialty. Way beyond putting cookies in shoes he wouldn't repair. The Jews have a word for such deeds, mitzvah. Mrs. Angel died recently, and now I can go further and tell you even more about the rest of the story. When Eli met his Rachel, it was love at first sight. He proposed after knowing her 2 days. She turned him down. Why? Because she had cancer. She had been told she could not have children and would not live long. But he insisted he would love her until the end, whenever it came. With love as a shield against impending doom, they married, and love produced 4 children, and love and luck kept them together into old age. Mrs. Angel was as good at mitzvah as her husband, a conspirator in doing goods without getting caught at it. All of this is absolutely true. And I know all this because I recently spent time talking with the angels. Eli's son is a third-generation cobbler, running his father's shop up on Capitol Hill in Seattle. People in the neighborhood speak of Raymond Angel as they once spoke of his father, a real mensch, a worthy man. I watched him engage customers with patience and attention, another mitzvah specialist, I thought to myself. I spoke with Raymond's sisters and his daughter, saw the family scrapbooks. Eli Angel and his dear wife Rachel were talked about as if they were still around, still taking care of their corner of the world. And I went away, reminded that not all people are no damned good. And the world is not going completely to hell. I went away admonished and blessed. The evangelist Billy Graham says angels are real, we just can't see them. Wrong. I know where the real angels are. I have seen them with my own eyes. Some angels I know can fix your souls and mend your soul at the same time. Now, for an old story I would not think of changing, it's called Hide and Seek. In the early dry dark of an October Saturday evening, the neighborhood children are playing hide and seek. How long since I played hide and seek? 50 years, maybe more. I remember how. I could become part of the game in a moment if invited, but adults don't play hide and seek, not for fun, anyway. Too bad. Did you have a kid in your neighborhood who always hid so good nobody could find him? We did. After a while, we would give up on him and go off, leaving him to rot wherever he was, and sooner or later he would show up all mad because we didn't keep looking for him. And we would get mad back because he wasn't playing the game the way it was supposed to be played. There's hiding and there's finding, we'd say, and he'd say it was hide and seek, not hide and give up, and we'd yell about who made the rules and who cared about who anyway and how we wouldn't play with him anymore if he didn't get it straight and who needed him anyhow and things like that. Hide and seek and yell. No matter what, though, the next time he would hide too good again. He's probably still hidden somewhere, for all I know. As I write this, the neighborhood game goes on, and there is a kid under a pile of leaves in the yard just under my window. He has been there for a long time now, and everybody else is found, and they are about to give up on him over at the base. I considered going out to the base and telling him where he's hiding, and I thought about setting the leaves on fire to drive him out, and finally I just yelled, "Get found, kid!" out the window. And scared him so bad he probably wet his pants and started crying and ran home to tell his mother. It's real hard to know how to be helpful sometimes. A man I know found out last year he had terminal cancer. He was a doctor, and he knew about dying, and he didn't want to make his family and friends suffer through that with him. So he kept his secret and died. Everybody said how brave he was to bear his suffering in silence and not tell everybody and so on and so forth, but privately his family and friends said how angry they were that he didn't need them, didn't trust their strength, and it hurt that he didn't say goodbye. He hid too well. Getting found would have kept him in the game. Hide-and-seek grown-up style, wanting to hide, needing to be sought, confused about being found. I don't want anyone to know. What will people think? I don't want to bother anyone. Better than hide-and-seek. I like the game called Sardines. In Sardines, the person who is it goes and hides, and everybody else goes looking for him. When you find him, you get in with him and hide there with him. And pretty soon, everybody's hiding together, all stacked in a small space like puppies in a pile, and pretty soon somebody giggles and somebody laughs and everybody is found. Medieval theologians even described God in hide-and-seek terms, calling him Deus absconditus, the absent God. But me, I think old God is a sardine player and will be found the same way everybody gets found in sardines, by the sound of laughter of those heaped together at the end. Ali Ali oxen free, Ali Ali oxen free. The kids out in the street are hollering the cry that says, Come on in, wherever you are, it's a new game. And so say I to all those adults who have hid too good. Get found, kid. Olly olly oxen free. Get found. Now I will tell you about chicken fried steak. The winding down of summer puts me in a philosophical mood. I am thinking about the deep, very private needs of people. Needs that, when met, give us a great sense of well-being. We don't like to talk about these for fear that people will not understand, but to increase our level of intimacy, I will tell you about one of my needs, chicken fried steak. You take a piece of stringy beef, you pound the hell out of it with a kitchen sledge, you dip the meat in egg and flour, drop it in a skillet with bacon drippings, and fry it up crisp. There you've got it, chicken fried steak. Next, you take the meat out of the pan, throw in some flour and milk and salt and pepper, and you got serious gravy. On the plate with the steak, you lay peas and mashed potatoes and then dump on the gravy. Some cornbread and butter and a quart of cold whole milk on the side are necessary. And then you take knife and fork in hand, hunker down close to the trough, lift your eyes heavenward in praise of the wonders of the Lord, and don't stop until you've mopped up the last trace of gravy with the last piece of cornbread. Disgusting, you say. Absolutely disgusting. Sure. Like a lot of good eating, this began as a way to disguise a sorry piece of old meat so you can't see it or taste it. And you probably eat something that stands for home and happiness that I wouldn't approach without a Geiger counter and a bomb squad. It's okay. You eat yours, I'll eat mine. Everybody has these minor secret yearnings in life. I've kind of been keeping my eye out for the ultimate chicken fried steak experience. You have to look in truck stops and little country towns off the freeway, little temples of the holy meal out there in the underbrush, reached by blue highways or dirt roads. If you're still interested in this topic, one summer's search produced these results. 1 star to the Torrey's Bar and Grill in Weezer, Idaho. Free toothpicks, too. 2 stars to the Farewell Bend Cafe in Farewell Bend, Oregon, with special praise for a side of graveyard stew, which is milk toast, and that's another story. 2 stars to the Blue Bucket in Umatilla, Oregon. Free mints afterward. 3 stars to the Rooster Tail Truck Stop on 6th Avenue South in Seattle. The waitress used to drive a truck in Alabama, and she knows all about chicken fried steak. 5 stars and a bouquet to Maud Owens Cafe in Payette, Idaho, where the chicken fried steak hangs over the edge of the plate and is accompanied by parsley, a spiced peach, 2 dill pickles, and a fried egg, and free toothpicks, and free mints, and a map of Payette under the plate. The manager shook my hand when I left. Waitress gave me a kiss on the cheek. I left her a big tip. I don't think anybody had ever eaten the whole thing before, and I could still taste it 3 days later. The Rolling Stones are famous for their phrase about how you can't always get what you want, but sometimes you can get what you need. Well, I'm here to tell you that you sometimes can get what you want and what you need at the same time with free toothpicks and mints and a kiss for topping. A parenthesis, a commentary from Time. I wrote that Gloria to the chicken fried steak a long, long time ago, but I have not changed my mind one bit. After the story appeared in print, I got a call from a traveling salesman who had checked out the cafes I mentioned in the story. He had an update. Some were still cooking. But one of the best had been closed by the health authorities. Seems they found dirt in the cream gravy. The salesman said he was told that the cafe regulars figured now they knew the cafe's secret ingredient. He nominated Mom's Cafe in Salina, Utah. I went. I ate. A 4-star winner. To guarantee that a blue ribbon version of chicken fried steak will always be available close by, I once made a special arrangement with my favorite Seattle cafe, The Shanty, on the waterfront on Elliott Avenue West. No dress code, no valet parking, no violence. A sign on the wall says all perverts must be on a leash. my kind of place. On the dinner menu now is the Captain Kindergarten Blue Plate Special. It's gourmet chicken fried steak, an aged, choice, lean New York strip steak that's been butterflied open, pounded, dipped in fresh egg wash, peppered, dredged with flour and bread crumbs from sourdough bread, and fried light golden brown, 90 seconds on a side, on a hot grill that has been greased with a little butter and a touch of bacon drippings. The steak covers the whole platter it's served on. Everything that goes with it comes in little dishes on the side. Rolls, soup or salad, mashed or French fried potatoes, corn or green beans, a pitcher of cream gravy, and fresh seasonal fruit or custard pie. Endless iced tea or coffee. A toothpick, a mint, great conversation, and a hug from the waitress, worth a generous tip. I once talked them into cooking chicken fried bacon for me. Oh, sure, I know if you eat this way, you'll die. So, if you don't eat this way, you're still going to die. Why not die happy? Here's a story about Charles Boyer. This is kind of personal. Fair warning, I may get a little choked up. It may get a little syrupy, so watch out. I know you'll understand. It started as a note to my wife, and then I thought that since some of you might have husbands or wives and might feel the same way, I'd pass it along. I don't own this story anyway. Charles Boyer does. Remember Charles Boyer? Suave, dapper, handsome, graceful, lover of the most famous and beautiful ladies of the silver screen. That was on camera and in the fan magazines, of course. In real life, it was different. There was only one woman in his life for 44 years, his wife, Patricia. Friends said it was a lifelong love affair, soulmates. They were no less lovers and friends and companions after 44 years than after the first year. And then Patricia developed cancer of the liver, and though the doctors told Charles he could not bear to tell her, and so he sat by her bedside to provide hope and cheer, day and night, for 6 months. He could not change the inevitable, nobody could, and Patricia died in his arms. 2 days later, Charles Boyer was also dead by his own hand. He said he did not want to live without her. He said, "Her love was life to me." This was no movie. As I said, it's the real story, Charles Boyer's story. It is not for me to pass judgment on how he handled his grief, but it is for me to say that I am touched and comforted in a strange way, touched by the depth of love behind the apparent sham of Hollywood love life, and comforted to know that a man and a woman can love each other that much, that long. I don't know how I would handle my grief in similar circumstances. I pray I shall never have to stand in his shoes. Here comes the personal part, so no apologies. But there are moments when I look across the room amid the daily ordinariness of life, and I see the person I call my wife and friend and companion, and I understand why Charles Boyer did what he did. It really is possible to love someone that much. I know. I am certain of it. Speaking of love, here's a view from Raccoons. This is about love and a house I once lived in, an elderly lakeside cottage built at the end of the road at the end of the 19th century, a summer place for a family who traveled by horse and buggy out from Seattle through deep woods and over steep hills on logging trails. It was wild there then, and it is wild there still. The house sat off the ground on bricks, surrounded by thickets of blackberry bushes and morning glory vines bent on a struggle to the death, and even though it is only minutes now from downtown, squirrels, rabbits, feral pussycats, and things I never saw but only heard had long established squatters' rights on the property. And raccoons. We had raccoons, big ones, several. For reasons known only to God and the hormones of raccoons, they chose to mate underneath my house every spring. And for reasons known only to God and the hormones of raccoons, they chose to mate underneath my house at 3 a.m. Until you have experienced raccoons.